I knew it was coming. We all knew it was coming. Almost every crew in California was getting called to this fire at some point.
It's 2020, Kelly Ramsey's first fire season in Northern California. She joined a hotshot crew, which is kind of like joining the Navy SEALs of wildfires. And for their last assignment, they get sent to a massive fire that's been burning for nearly 2 months.
It was something like 37 fire starts that eventually was more than 1 million acres.
By this point, the wildfires consumed an area 5 times bigger than New York City.
So I'm sitting in the back with, these 7 men, and we swing onto the highway. I'd been to big fires already at that point. I'd been to 100,000, 200,000 acre fires. But a fire that big, you might take an hour to get from one side of it to another. This was 5 or 6 hours just going from the eastern part of the fire to the northern part. So already, it's this feeling of like, oh my God.
They pass through a charred moonscape filled with thick yellow smoke. And when they do see fire, even experienced crew members go,
Whoa! And kind of everybody in the back of the buggy turns and is like, look at that fire behavior or look at that column or whatever. And often you don't say anything at all. Everybody's just like, oh, shit.
So one of their assignments is to cut off a wildfire before it reaches the highway. The goal is to create a dead zone so the wildfire has nothing left to consume. Right now, the wind is working in their favor. So they grab their torches and start dripping fire.
So that night, we've been burning for, I don't know, 12 hours or something. I sort of lose track of time. And I'm on the road with my buddy, and we've just dragged 2 strips of fire with our drip torches down the edge of this road. And the fire is romping. It is torching trees en masse, which is so like a, torching is when the tree kind of goes up like a Roman candle, just like all at once. Whoosh, it just like lights from the bottom to the top. So these trees had been torching just like 10 at a time. Whoosh, and it sounds like a jet engine roar, Feels scary, but for the entire day, the wind has been pushing in to, let's say, my right or to the east. It's been pushing in toward the main fire. So it's drawing all those flames in toward the main fire, and it's also drawing the smoke all over toward the main fire. So that's what we want to see. Perfect. But at this moment, I'm on the road with my buddy, and all of a sudden the wind shifts. You see this like wall of smoke in the sky just kind of shift and fall over. And you can see all these bright orange sparks just wafting into the air and then landing.
Without missing a beat, the crew begins playing what Kelly describes as spot fire whack-a-mole.
This massive ember wash is just raining over the road.
They want to keep the biggest fire in California's history from becoming even bigger.
Obviously, this is really not what you want.
In this episode, we're going to hear more from Kelly about what life is like on the front lines of wildfires. We're also going to hear from Canadian and Australian firefighters who've watched climate change turn wildfires into unstoppable events. They say there's a very real threat that wildfires will start hitting places across the globe that used to be safe. This is Living Planet. I'm Kathleen Schuster.
So we spread out about 10, 20 feet in a line. So we're looking for these embers that are falling out of the sky all over us, like falling stars. And they're tiny. Often they will be, a piece of a burning leaf that is, let's say, the size of a quarter or even like a dime. Something that small can start an entirely new wildfire. So when it catches and it, lands in some duff or some dry leaves or some dry pine needles and it starts to form a fire, you're walking through the forest in the darkness, and what you're looking for is essentially a tiny glow. It's like the flicker of a little candle.
Within a matter of minutes, they see an ember land in a dry, rotten tree stump.
So by the time we get there, this thing is already a 10 by 10 foot blade.
For non-U.S. listeners, that's 3 by 3 meters.
Like, the entire stump is just engulfed in flame and smoldering, and then it started to creep into the ground cover and, you know, little plants and grasses around the stump, and it's already starting to establish itself as a fire. So we immediately got 5 or 6 people just, you know, digging a little hand line around it, and then we called for an engine to bring water, and it wasn't hard to catch it, but, you know, imagine if we didn't.
This is just the first of many spot fires Kelly and her crew will have to pounce on before the night is over. And as they race to prevent this million-acre fire from gaining even more ground, Kelly feels the entire summer of extreme wildfires in her muscles and in her mind. We're going to come back to Kelly and also find out why none of us should kid ourselves into thinking we could survive hotshot training. Trust me, we wouldn't. But before we do that, let's stick with this image of uncontrollable embers a few moments longer. Wildland firefighters are trained to deal with normal fire behavior, including what to do about embers, of course. What's changing, though, is that, as one expert put it, climate change hasn't just turned up the dial. It's flipped a switch, meaning it's not just amplifying fire behavior, it's changing the predictability of wildfires altogether.
When you're flying, you can still be feeling that heat.
Hugh Murdoch is one of 5 incident commanders for British Columbia's Wildfire Service. He's been fighting wildfires in Canada for over 30 years.
But it's remarkable to me that I've been on fires now where you've had a good speed, and you just keep going and going and going, and the fire is just there outside your right-hand window, and it's just percolating away, and the trees look so small in comparison to the flames. And then if you fly down closer to the ground level, and you get a better appreciation for how big those trees really are, and they're not small. Seeing fires growing not just by a methodical march of the perimeter or the fire's edge, but by throwing embers well in advance of itself.
If we imagine for a second a wildfire capable of throwing an ember a mile or roughly 2 kilometers ahead of itself, then it's not that hard to picture how fast these fires can move through a forest that's too dry. Or even being capable of blowing clear across lakes and rivers, Hugh says.
Yeah, fires are certainly getting much, much bigger. The difference is really very significant.
So picture an area about the size of Manhattan, maybe just slightly smaller. That's about how big Hugh says a good-sized wildfire used to be. It would grow by about 10% a day. Now, these huge wildfires are able to grow by the size of a Manhattan, if you will, in one single day.
And the intensity that it's burning is just really, really growing at an alarming rate.
This trend is being seen in other regions too. Take, for example, a study released last year by researchers at the University of Colorado Boulder. The researchers looked at satellite data from the last 2 decades. They found that wildfires in the American West grew about 250% faster over a 24-hour period compared to wildfires in 2001. And in that same period, it was exactly those fast-moving fires that caused the most destruction. They also cost about $19 billion to suppress.
You know, the helicopters will only want to get so close to those large fires because there's so much heat coming off of the forest. Like the typical hot air rises. Well, that's awfully hot air. So it's rising very, very quickly. And it's sucking air in to fill that void. So inevitably, these large fires can make their own weather and their own winds.
Before we get into how exactly fire can create its own wind and weather, it's worth considering what it takes, both physically and mentally, for someone to even become a wildland firefighter. Let's take Kelly and the hotshot crew she was on as an example. First off, why are they called hotshots?
It doesn't just mean like, oh, because we're the coolest, like, oh, you're such a hotshot. I think it's probably about like the heat of the work that we do.
And that heat starts with building muscle and stamina during basic training.
So you are definitely hiking. And when I say hiking, I don't mean a hiking trail. I mean, like, you look at an incredibly steep vertical mountain where your face is like looking at the slope. When you're standing on it, the slope is like in your face, you know? And you have to maintain a certain crew pace, and you have to carry at least 45 pounds, but most people carry 60 plus pounds up that hill.
45 pounds is about 20 kilos, or the equivalent of carrying a child on your back.
You have to be able to meet a bunch of specific qualifications, like running a mile and a half in 10 and a half minutes. You have to do a certain number of sit-ups, push-ups, pull-ups.
They do calisthenics like wall sits and leg lifts.
And I worked with several guys who had been Marines, and they said that being a hotshot was harder than being a Marine. And I got that from another guy who had been an Army Ranger.
And just like any other elite team, they have a specific look. Yellow shirts, green pants, and here, the importance of their boots cannot be emphasized enough.
Yeah, the boots are a big deal. And there's really differing boot styles and opinions on boots, even from hotshot crew to hotshot crew. So the crew that I was on was really big on super tall boots, like boots that came up pretty much to the knee or at least mid shin, like 16-inch boots. They're leather. And most hotshots that I know prefer a boot with a little bit of a stacked heel. It's easier to just stand on a super steep slope if you have a bit of a heel to the boot.
All fire resistant, of course. Hotshots are among the first in and the last out. Their main tasks are digging line, literally digging shallow trenches to break the forward march of a wildfire, and preventative burning as needed. The point is to get rid of any potential fuel well in advance, or even down to the wire.
You are literally right next to the flames or within, you know, 10, 20 feet of the flames. And in that case, you're digging line fast. So yeah, I've had situations where I was digging line and there are, you know, 2 or 3 foot flames that are just a few feet away from me. And in that case, you really move.
When the fire's finally out, the hotshots get to mop up, turning over and testing every last inch of sometimes miles of where the fire was to make sure it's really out. After long days of this for at least 2 weeks at a time, everything hurts.
I had like sort of knots in my forearms. My hands started to go numb, and they didn't stop being numb until a couple months after the season ended. You also will get like a chafe in your armpits from the pack rubbing against your flesh. So the skin will like become raw and open, and you have to kind of like bandage it up or tape it up in order to keep working.
So this is more or less the condition the crew is in the night they're racing to put out every last ember.
And it ended up taking until 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, and at this time we've been on since 6 o'clock the previous morning. But we, and, you know, not just our crew, but other crews and a couple of engines that have been sent to help us, we managed to catch all of these fires. And we're able to know that at least along that road, our burn has held. It's going to be okay. And we've, you know, hopefully been able to contain the main fire.
They're all keyed up. They climb back into their buggy and head for the campsite.
And everyone's throwing Gatorades to everybody else. And you strip off your yellow shirt, because we only wear those when we're on the line. We don't wear them to like hang out. We definitely don't sleep in them. So you strip off that shirt and change into a dry cotton shirt and then sit down in the buggy. And there's this amazing feeling of peace as the buggy just rumbles through the darkness back to where we're going to camp. You know, so there's like the first relief is you unlace the boots and pull them off. And it's like your feet are released from this straight jacket. And then you pull off the sweaty socks and your feet are completely free. And then you take off these salt and ash and sweat crusted pants and you put on long underwear. None of the clothing is clean at this point, but the semi-clean clothing against your body is just like an intense relief and just so comforting. And then you snuggle into your sleeping bag. And I think that night, I didn't even need a melatonin or a Benadryl or anything. I just was gratified and tired and looked up at the sky and just fell asleep.
We'll be right back.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We're with The World, Public Radio's leading global news program.
We cover the biggest news events developing every day and give you the context you need to make sense of them.
And Carolyn, I also like our smaller stories, tales of discovery and human kindness, things that make us laugh.
Stories that kind of shrink our world and make us feel more connected.
Subscribe and listen every weekday to The World.
You know, I have to say, what's super striking about this interview is you, like, are so happy telling me all of this.
I'm, like, dreaming. That's so true.
And I fully appreciate that. But I'm just like, there's a bit of a disconnect for me. I'm like, wait.
It's so fun. It's so fun. It's the most fun job I've ever and probably will ever do.
Kelly says it's crazy. And it really is, considering how tough her first fire season was. Not only did she get deployed to California's largest wildfire in history, the August Complex, but she says that summer, her team racked up over 1,000 hours of overtime in less than 5 months. And it's very likely that a good number of the U.S.'s 100 or so hotshot crews had similar experiences that year. In 2020, the U.S. came within just a few thousand acres of matching its worst fire season on record, which was 2015. Both times, over 10 million acres, or 4 million hectares of land, went up in flames. One thing stands out, though. The number of fires in 2020 was actually lower, going back to what experts are saying. These fast-moving fires are much more destructive. So Kelly goes on to do a second grueling year. She loves it, but she knows not everyone feels that way. Hugh Murdoch up in British Columbia mentions a big shift he's noticed. The fires are getting worse, and fire responders are caught between the pressure from the job and the pressure from the public to stop the unstoppable. Hugh says in his community about 4 hours east of Vancouver, the tension is real and mounting.
You know, I would not wear a shirt that identified myself as an employee of the British Columbia Wildfire Service in certain communities, for certain.
Really?
Like 100%. And that's not uncommon. And yet, literally 5 years ago, you'd wear it with pride. And now it's just like, I don't want to get dumped on at the grocery store. And to be clear, too, there's an awful lot of people that support what you're doing. But it's just not worth the attention at all.
I mean, if you don't mind my asking, have you had somebody approach you before and chew you out? Or?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And we've got a cabin at a lake just east of here. It's an area where tourism is important and the forest industry is important. And we had a horrific fire there in 2023.
When he does go to his cabin, he keeps a low profile. But some of his coworkers don't have that luxury because the fallout can be felt within their own four walls.
You know, that their families are irate with them. It's like made Thanksgiving dinners and Christmases and whatnot awkward for people.
That year, nearly 2,300 fires burned across British Columbia, causing more than $720 million Canadian dollars in damages between August and September alone. 2023 was Canada's worst fire season ever recorded. Between mid-April and late October, there were times when fires were burning from coast to coast, destroying an area bigger than England. You might also remember those fires from images of the smoke that drifted down into the U.S. and blanketed New York City. The smoke caused New York's temperature to drop by 3 degrees Celsius that June. Things got so bad that other countries sent in personnel to help.
We got an awful lot of assistance from the United States. Strange, like very, very strange that in Canada's busiest year, the United States was having one of their quietest years on record ever.
That year, the U.S. was able to send nearly 2,500 people to help out, which might not have happened if it had had as busy a fire season as Canada. To be clear, Canada relied on long-standing agreements with its other partners, too. Mexico, Costa Rica, and crucially, three partners in the Southern Hemisphere. South Africa, New Zealand, and Australia. But even that wasn't enough. When all was said and done, 12 countries had to send help. If they hadn't, Hugh says,
I'm absolutely convinced the landscape would look very different today than it does.
What comes up again and again with different fire experts from the U.S., Canada, and Australia is that climate change is making wildfires more extreme. And this is pushing fire response to its limits because, and they all agree on this, there is no technology in the world that can replace manpower. And manpower, of course, has its limits.
It's a daunting task, but you know, we don't get asked to stop hurricanes or tornadoes or tsunamis. It would be naive to think that we can stop all forest fires. And that's partly how we got into this mess too, right? We've been very good at putting out fires when they're small for a very long period of time. But every year there's a buildup of more and more dead material on the ground. And there's a buildup of more and more resources that are vulnerable to fire, whether it's homes or cell towers or fence lines or recreational properties or businesses. So there's more in front of these fires as well. But when a lightning system comes through and starts 100 fires in a very small area in one day, we just have to be realistic about the fact that we're not going to get all these fires put out in their infancy.
Especially because, as Hugh mentioned before, extreme wildfires are creating their own wind and their own weather. Rick McRae has been watching this trend in Australia for decades.
So when I left work just a few hours before New Year's Eve, a car park was very close to the airport control tower. I could barely see the airport control tower, which is never a good thing for an international airport. And it turned out at that point we had the worst air quality in the world.
We're going to skip back in time for a moment to the days leading up to 2020, right smack dab in the middle of an Australian fire season that's gone down in history as the Black Summer. That evening, when Rick walks out to his car, Australia is in the middle of an outbreak of fire thunderstorms known as pyrosibs. What's a pyrosib, you ask?
Well, first I got to correct you. It's pyro CB.
My mistake. Pyro CB. The CB stands for cumulonimbus, the meteorological term for thunderclouds, and pyro for fire, of course. Rick says meteorologists complain that pyro CB isn't actually the right term.
They say, well, actually, it's a cumulonimbus flammagenitus. And strangely, that term never took off.
That really would be a mouthful. So pyro CB it is. Rick has decades of experience in bushfire response and now researches these types of phenomena alongside the Fire Research Unit at the University of New South Wales in Canberra. What Rick's talking about is when the large smoke column from a wildfire goes extreme and becomes something more on par with a volcanic plume. A pyro CB can be seen from far off, but not so well up close.
So most people's direct experience is that eerie, blackened sky in the early afternoon and the red glows and the embers starting to brew up.
Rick says the land is becoming fully flammable, and that's creating the conditions for infernos that generate fire thunderstorms. That year, Australia had just experienced 2 years in a row of dry conditions and was in the grips of one of its hottest and driest years on record. All of that fuel created hot air powerful enough to punch right through the atmosphere and up into the stratosphere.
So you can end up at the top of the cloud 15, 16 kilometers above sea level, which is really extraordinary stuff. And the base of this thing might be 20 square kilometers, and because it's expanding as it goes, it's the size of a very large thunderstorm. Now, the temperature at the top of the cloud can get to, say, minus 60 Celsius. And once it passes minus 40 Celsius as it rises, it can create lightning, pyrogenic lightning. And this even has the ability to start new fires downwind.
Over the span of about a week, Australia's bushfires spawned 18 of these massive fire thunderstorms. The air quality index in Canberra hits 5,500, 23 times levels considered safe. By the time Australia's unprecedented fire season comes to an end, nearly 50 million acres have burned, 33 people have died, and billions of plants and animals have been lost to the flames. We'll be right back.
Welcome to Those Who Can't Teach Anymore, a narrative podcast series that explores why teachers are leaving education and what can be done to stop the exodus. This season, we're getting a look at the year and the life of teachers from across the country through their audio journals.
I am Darcy Ostermiller.
This is Megan Overgoff.
This is Sophie V.
This is Charlie Blackwood.
This is Taylor Barron.
This is Iva Moss-Ridman.
This is David Whisker.
This is Dan Morris.
This is Amanda Smith.
Look for Those Who Can't Teach Anymore, Season 2, a different kind of the same thing.
Kelly's second year is intense and just as eventful as the first, maybe even more so. She watches firsthand as more than one crew member nearly gets killed by a falling tree. And her body starts to rebel.
I decided to step away for what I thought was one summer because I had some health problems that I wanted to address.
She develops an autoimmune disorder and can't help but wonder, was it the stress, the overexertion, the smoke? There's very little data on how many wildland firefighters have left, but Kelly seems to be just one of many. U.S. media reports point to a growing attrition rate of around 45% and application rates dropping by half in the past few years. The Canadian media has reported similar problems. As for Australia, AFAC, the country's Fire and Emergency Management Council, says Australia's robust firefighting network of professionals and volunteers is pretty stable in urban areas. But numbers are starting to decline slightly in rural areas, due in part to an aging population and the pressure of cost of living. Hugh and Rick can attest to how much harder these jobs are getting, and a big part of that is because of anthropogenic climate change. An international study by the World Weather Attribution found, for example, that climate change made Canada's wildfires in 2023 twice as likely. And if conditions stay as they are, that type of event will become seven times more likely in the future. Add to this even more tragic examples, like Los Angeles, where an unstoppable fire swept a mile and a half across the urban edge. A new record, Rick says. Or a sudden increased risk of extreme fires in areas that didn't used to make headlines, like South Korea. The good news is there are solutions, and one of them is bolstering personnel with firefighters from different countries, like what Hugh described a few minutes ago.
And I would say that, you know, that difference, whether it's 50 people or 500, wherever those people are, they're making a difference. So if it's 50 people onto one fire or 10 groups of 50 onto 10 different fires, it's pretty fantastic to have the help.
It's one way to share the load, the equipment, and also knowledge. Hugh himself spent time in Australia during the Black Summer. He also went down to Los Angeles during those fires in January, and he says there's always something new to learn. And especially when it comes to the Santa Ana winds that drove LA's fires, Rick says sharing that knowledge internationally will be vital for places like Australia, where there's been an uptick in these wind patterns too. Kelly ultimately takes an indefinite hiatus from the hotshot crew, with good reason, too. She became a mom.
You know, I did it for 2 years. I'm no longer a hotshot. I'm a washed-up former hotshot. But I do miss the job all the time. I, like, would love to go back to the job in some capacity, and it just is hard to see a way that that would be compatible with having a family. And I know a lot of people, including men, who struggle with this, and you know, there's a crisis of attrition in the profession. There's always a staffing shortage with federal wildland firefighters. And I think a huge part of that is how hard it is on families and on people who want to be parents. So, long-winded way of saying why I left.
There was one other thing Kelly did when she left the hotshot crew. She wrote a book. So if you want to know more about her story and what it takes to fight wildfires, you can check that out. It's called Wildfire Days: A Woman, a Hotshot Crew, and the Burning American West. If after hearing this episode, you're wondering about how to prepare for a wildfire, we've dropped a few links in the show notes to help get you started. What did you think of this episode? We want to know. You can send us an email at livingplanet.com or leave us a comment on Apple Podcasts. This episode was written, produced, and soundscaped by me, Kathleen Schuster. It was edited by Neil King. Our sound engineer was Jürgen Kuhn. Living Planet is produced by DW in Bonn, Germany.